Hello, my name is Zoltán Csiges, and this is Zoltán's podcast on coaching. In this series, I'm talking with internationally renowned coaching scientists and coaches. We explore their personal and professional insights on the science of coaching and on the helping professions. Are you interested in how they got close to this profession? Are you curious about the new frontiers they are exploring right now? Join me and listen to the conversation. Inspiration and some fun is ahead.
Hi, Joe. Thank you very much for being with me today. Today's guest is Joe Oliver, who is the founder of Contextual Consulting, an associate professor, a clinical psychologist, and ACT therapist. Have I missed anything from this very brief introduction?
Hi, Zoltán. Thank you very much for having me. No, that sounds about it. Yeah, that's a couple of my key roles within the university and also in contextual consulting. But there are other bits and pieces, but that, I think, summarizes at least my work life up relatively well. Thank you.
And may I ask for one bit or piece from your non-work life that you would be willing to share? Something that we could put in here immediately as something super new about you.
I'm a dad of two kids who are 3 and 5. We live in London, which is kind of a fairly international family. I'm from New Zealand. My wife is from Canada. We're all located for the moment in London, but that may well change in the future, but we'll see. So that's us. Yeah, we're a fairly active family. My wife, being from Canada, is very interested in why I am anyway, the snow. So we're very excited to be going on a ski holiday, which is very shortly, to take the kids skiing. And one of the real joys I found about parenting is doing these kind of things with kids. So much fun. Just about anything with kids a lot of things can be a lot more fun with kids there. So that's been really exciting, just with them, watching them experience the whole snow environment through fresh kid eyes. I love that. It's amazing.
I can really relate to that. Me being a father of two as well, my kids are a bit older. They are just 7 and 10. And we love hiking and going out to the nature. And they are very different when they are out there, and they have very different reactions to nature. So one of them is really, let's stop at every flower and admire it for minutes. The other one is like, okay, where is the next interesting adventure, the things that I can follow or whatever. So
right,
I can really relate to that.
Yeah.
But having kids around makes things a lot more fun.
Yeah,
I don't even know why I'm not working with kids, but it's a very different and a very long story.
All right. Yeah, indeed. I mean, some things are fun with kids, but some things are not as well. Certainly kind of adds a different dimension. But yeah, it's definitely fascinating. So what interesting watching them kind of, like you say, just how kids respond and just illuminating things that I might not see, or maybe I've forgotten about, or, you know, I sort of interact with the environment, like at the snow, like, oh, I've seen this before, I know this, but, you know, forget what it's like to throw myself down on the ground and make a snow angel, or have a snowball fight, or just, you know, jump up and down, and just the sort of the fun of it all, stuff that's novel and new.
So the spontaneity, what you are mentioning, that's something that is close to me. Let me ask one more, you know, between professional and personal question is, do you see your professional identity coming up in your family setting? So do you catch yourself sometimes doing therapy kind of stuff? Of course, not therapy, but therapeutically inspired intervention as a parent. So have you ever coached yourself doing that? Because sometimes I get the question, do you coach your kids? And I'm like, of course.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm laughing because I feel like if I any time do that with my wife, I get beaten over the head pretty quickly. No one wants kind of, I guess, why is that? It's the sort of professional thing. If you start engaging with someone in a sort of weird professional way, it's not really authentic. Especially with the kids, I feel like myself and my wife spend a lot of time trying to understand or make sense of, or this is going wrong, like how can we do this differently? And I guess, you know, some of my, of course, training and comes into the play. My wife's was a teacher. She now works with me, but she's got a lot of kind of experience in working with kids. So we sort of, you know, do a lot of that sitting down and figuring things. But yeah, I feel like the benefit for us is the two of us coming together, coming up with ideas. I never feel like I'm coming at it saying, this is what we should do, or this is the answer. It's never like that. It's like, oh, maybe this would work, or we could try this. Or she just yesterday said she'd seen this really cool video on Instagram from a child expert. I was like, oh, that's a really good idea. We should try that. Yeah, that's the kind of thing. But yeah, I feel like people sort of assume as people are like us, if we're therapists or psychotherapists, that somehow we're doing this all the time. Like, you know, like that thing. Do you ever get that when you go to a party and you introduce yourself and people say, oh, you're reading my mind? I'm sure you get that.
Yes, definitely. Well, it's good to know that there are other normal helping professional people out there.
Yeah, you and me, we're normal, absolutely.
Thank you very much for this. And there was two things that really that caught my attention as you were speaking. And the first one is that you said that when you get to therapy, perhaps I'm not quoting you properly, is that it may look weird or not authentic, that kind of relating to the other person. And how I met you, how I found you first on the net was one of your short videos around HDG. And I really loved your very spontaneous and authentic presence in that video. I don't know whether it was recorded for 100 times or I know the things behind the videos, or I guess I have some idea. Uh-huh. But you were really there. I could really see you. That was my impression. I really see you as a person. And that's how the whole topic of authenticity came to me when I had the opportunity to talk to you. How do you see authenticity as an ingredient in a helping profession? And if we have to add that pre-talk, we talked about you not being a coach, but you are more of a therapist, and I'm coming more from the coaching profession. I'm just curious on your idea on authenticity as an element of the helping relationship. So how do you see that?
I think it's really, really important. It's for me to be able to show up in front of my client and be authentic. And of course, authenticity means a lot of things, right? In the ways that I can show up and be authentic. Authentic doesn't mean for me, in a professional sense, being completely transparent. That's not necessary, and probably a lot of senses would be really unhelpful. But I feel like there's an alignment in terms of a whole lot of things coming together, which are my own personal values, my own actions and behaviors as they show up in a session, then the kind of things that I talk about and mention and describe all kind of come into that sphere of authenticity. A lot of that can be, I would say, responding authentically to the person in front of me, being letting my value shine through to a degree, often to a large degree, being there as a whole person in front of the person. I feel like my own experience of being on the other side of either coaching or therapy is that it's something I really look for. And I'm really kind of quite sensitized too. If I ever get a sense that someone's being inauthentic, then it just puts me off really quickly. I'm not looking for someone to tell me about their whole lives. I just sort of the sense of this alignment is in place. They walk the talk, that they're, you know, they're a good person. They're there for me. They're going to help me. And that there's a sense of their values coming to the fore as well.
True. I so frequently hear the word transparency associated with authenticity. You coming up with and being aware of your goddamn words family. So this is the thing that I'm going to cut with your vulnerabilities. And being up there in front of your clients, showing up as a vulnerable person, your perspective saying that authenticity is more of an alignment and having a strong filter, these are my words, having a filter that not showing off everything to your client or a professional partner, that's a real different approach. I haven't really seen that or haven't really heard that previously. And I really like this alignment. My next question to that is that, can you imagine yourself having different kinds of presences for different clients? Very different, however, still very authentic presents. So where in one of them, you may have an X value shining through, or another one having a Y value coming through.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that is a really important ingredient. Good sessions, be they coaching or be they therapeutic, the person to a degree can adapt themselves to fit with the needs of the client. It's a really interesting interaction, because I'm saying that it could sound a little bit like I'm inauthentic, or I start acting or portraying myself in a different way, but that's not what I mean. And which is to say, like, when that alignment is in place, that I have my clear values and I have my clear sort of sense of how I want to help this person, and there are maybe some different behaviors I need to do, or different kind of facets of myself, or different ways I need to interact. So in some situations, I might need to be much more front-footed with the person, much more direct and blunt, honest perhaps, giving them, say, for example, honest feedback on their behavior, say that's happening live. And there are other times that that's just really inappropriate or just really unnecessary. Say, for example, where someone just needs to spend a lot of time perhaps reviewing an experience, or not unloading, but sort of making sense of, then in that situation, the behavior for me needs to be a lot more stepped back, containing, listening, and reflecting. But I feel like those are both authentic, right? They're both, it's still me with a strong value wanting to be as helpful as possible to the person. And then my goals get manifested a different way. And then the kind of behaviors sort of show through differently. People need different things at different points. And maybe even during a meeting, you know, I might need to kind of move things around a little bit.
I absolutely agree with that. What I asked is, I'm not a big knower of ACT, but really caught my attention as I was reading books and started to attend courses, is the importance of values behind your presence. And this is one of my questions for, in general, and for you as an ACT expert, is that how do you manage a set of values in your presence? Is it just like playing with a number of different balls, throwing one or two or whatever, what seems to be necessary, or fitting the client? Am I quasi transparent and showing all of them at the same time? So how do you work with a bigger repertoire of your own values? Because one more thing for that, my assumption is that as we get older and hopefully wiser, people get more complex from a psychological perspective. And my guess is that we may have more and more values integrated into ourselves. I don't really have a clear question here. That's what I'm realizing as I'm talking to you, because my mind is thinking of, I'm getting less values as we develop in our lives, so more solid foundation, more clarity, or are we getting more complex and complicated with more and more legs on which we are standing?
That's like 20 questions in one there.
One of my mentors told me that it's a good thing to ask many questions, because your audience then will find their own one.
All right. That's interesting. One of my supervisors told me, don't ask so many questions, just ask one at a time. And I never listened to that. I always ask lots and lots of questions. I feel like I'm sort of slowly circling around on the point I eventually want to make. And sometimes I get there and sometimes I don't. Oh, one thing to say, it's a peculiar thing. So it's the acronym ACT, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. The community has chosen to pronounce it as ACT rather than ACT, which is a bit odd because most other approaches use the letters spelt out. It's a little bit deliberate because there's sort of the word ACT points towards this piece, which is helping people to be less stuck and take action towards chosen ends. Typically values is the direction of the therapy. So it's a bit odd, but anyway, just as a point. But you're right, it's values is a really strong hallmark feature of this approach. And it's asking lots of questions, like really getting down to meaning and purpose, and probably some quite deep questions for people often. What do they want from life and what really matters to them? The funny thing about the word values is that there's, of course, lots of different ways that our culture uses values. It uses that word. It can mean all sorts of things. Of course, we have family values, we have corporate values, and you know, we have societal values. And then we have these ACT values, which are similar-ish but different. And the different piece is that they're linked to a behavior, and you could say they're there to be helpful, to be influencing a behavior. So that's to say that it's a bit, you could maybe use the metaphor of a compass. So a compass provides us with a direction, and we pull our compass out in a given moment, and it says, which if I want to head west, then I need to go in a west direction. So right in this moment, it's saying this is, it's going to influence my behavior. So to move west, I move in this direction. The values compass says in this particular moment, I want to respond with authenticity. Then this is the kind of behaviors that I'll do. Like, you know, right now, as I'm speaking with you, I could choose that and say, you know, that authenticity, as it happens, is a value of mine. For a lot of reasons, and there'll be things that will be influencing the answers that I give, how I talk with you and interact, like right in these moments. Rather than it being a really abstract thing that's distal and, you know, is sort of pie in the sky, values from an ACT perspective really influence me kind of in terms of moment by moment. Someone once described, you know, I'm not great with grammar, but it's a value is best described as an adverb, which is a verb, you know, the action, but it's describing an adjective for a verb. So describing the quality of an action. Rather than me saying, I want to be authentic, you know, this is a grand value. It's like, what about right now? Here, as I'm speaking with you, Zoltan, I want to be authentic. I want to act authentically. And I wonder, you know, I think to myself, let me think what that would mean for me right in this moment, that then my behavior would be shaped up and influenced in that way.
Thank you. I really love this on-the-spot approach, because it makes it more tangible and usable, honestly, in any of the settings that I can imagine. Let me get back to the bunch of questions that I've asked together, because they are starting to make more sense as we are talking. You mentioned that lots of types of values, but these actionable values, let me call them this way, play a key role in how you work with ACT. You see, I'm getting into the community. So that, thank you very much for teaching me how to use it, how to pronounce it properly. How long does it take for people? I know there is no such a thing as an average client, but how long does it take for people to get closer to their values or to identify them? You know, differently when I'm, when I was in meetings, for example, in corporate programs, organizational development work, there were lots of long sessions where we try to identify corporate values.
Yeah, that's a good question as to whether it's possible. But a rough rule of thumb would be the more complicated the situation is, the harder it will be to identify values. My experience in coaching is most of the time that the people when I've been coaching find it relatively easy to identify values, which is to say they describe a stuck situation or a problem or a place where they want to do better. A straightforward question to say, like, in this situation, what matters most to you? What's most important? What's your purpose? I find oftentimes people can, with a bit of nudging or a bit of time for reflection, will better identify what's really important. Sometimes it might need a bit of shaping up and considering. And, you know, if someone said straight away a really quick answer, I might want to just delve in a little bit, give them a little bit more space to reflect. Perhaps, you know, maybe an exercise or some more questions. I've also found, though, that the more complicated it is, the more thorny, the more stuck they are, which is to say the more of the emotional content is wrapped around it, the more painful it is, the harder it is. So in my work as a therapist, if I was working with, say, people who have had, you know, really long, painful histories and difficult, stuck problems that have gone on for years, if not decades, values would be incredibly hard. Often these are folks who have never been asked values questions. Life's never afforded them the opportunity to even think about what they care about. It just hasn't been there. So asking them in a first session, you know, what do you care about? What are your values? They will say either a really quick answer, oh, I care about my family, or I care about my friends, or just a thin answer. Or they'll say, I don't know. That's usually kind of like my metric, as it were. The emotional part, like if you're really diving into values territory, you kind of know you're getting there because it should be less kind of dry and dusty. I had that image of kind of sitting around and talking about corporate values. It's like, oh, I couldn't think of anything more boring than that. It's got to be done though, right? But that's a different exercise. That's people trying to kind of come together, you know, to often a branding, maybe a marketing, or it's an issue in terms of like a directional piece. But the bit that's harder is the personal attachment, the emotion is often missing. Of course it is, right? If we're talking about a big, you know, corporation, for example. But good values exercises when the individual is invited to really connect with their own kind of emotion and feeling. And I've seen some really nice exercises where people have done corporate values exercises, tied it together with the individual's own values, giving some space for discrepancies, of course, but also identifying the overlap. And that's when people can really get behind a group set of values. And that's when they become really powerful. And it's powerful because it's theirs. It's their, they have shared ownership over it. It really matters to them. They have skin in the game, as it were. And that's sort of hallmark is when it gets emotional, that's when you know you're in the right territory.
Thank you for saying that. And as you were speaking, I was thinking about the depth of work here, because my impression is that we may need to go into the full depth, you know, to neck deep understanding of what values are, but something more workable like keep deep, if I can use this being underwater kind. Am I right with this? So in order to help our clients, we don't need to get the fullest and most detailed understanding of their values, but something which is only workable in the moment.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, there can be a lot of depth to it, but it might not be not deep. I don't know, that's kind of sounds like a bit pejorative, like deep is good or not shallow is bad. But I sort of, you know, those sort of questions like just asking people, helping them to orientate in terms of what matters and what they care about. What they want to stand for in a situation really helps people plant that flag and have a sense of the things that in this particular situation, what they want to do, but also how they want to act, how they want to behave. People often, my experiences, and I say that for myself personally too, I find it really grounding. Got to have my values clear and well articulated. I'm just thinking of this current example where a while ago, I was invited to a talk at a conference. I was really busy and I was flat out and lots of things to do and just imagining all the time that would go into it. And I was also a bit nervous about it as well. It was kind of like it's a group of people who I know quite well. And I sort of thought, oh gosh, what if it all went wrong? And, you know, I stand up there and forget my kind of what I'm going to say, blah, blah, blah. And I've got nothing to say anyway. No one would be interested, blah, blah, blah. I'm too busy, rah, rah, rah. And this kind of whole lot of mind stuff came out. I was coming close to like just avoiding it, kind of creating some email excuse to say, I'm too busy. Then for whatever reason, something triggered me to think about a values thing, like, which is to say, like, is this important? Like, is this something that matters here? And as it happened, there was this kind of this thinking I've been going through, which was I've been reading this book about belonging to a group, and it's been really influential. I really liked it. And it was something important that I wanted to say in this group, which is about how do we as a group consciously and deliberately set up a good way that people can belong. All sorts of people can belong. Like, it's not a kind of like in-group, out-group, and that we can work towards a shared purpose. And suddenly I realized, actually, this is really important to me. I do want to say this. I feel like I want to say this in this space and have my kind of a little bit of a drop of the influence into the progression of this group. And then suddenly it changed. And all that kind of sort of mind chatter just sort of just eased off a little. It's still there. It'll come back, I'm sure, as closer I get to it. But it just kind of eased. And I was like, yeah, this is something that kind of does matter to me. I sort of tapped my chest because I could sort of feel it. It was a bit of more spaciousness. Then so on the basis of that, I accepted the invite, started kind of reading about it, and I started to get quite excited about it. I was like, oh, cool possibilities here. And I could say this, or we could do this, or this is going to be a bit of an adventure that I'm going to go on here. So that's maybe an example of the ways in which that valuing piece can be really useful.
Thank you very much. These two thoughts, professional one is the what I really like in the approach that you're outlining is that this way values are more contextual and more fluid for me, because I don't need to have just a single set of, let's say, these are my three values and then everything should be under them, like in a corporate environment where we have a mission, vision, five values, whatever. I'm just mocking that world then.
Sure.
So I'm not being too serious here, but so the flexibility that a value or something that is important can be important just in the here and now, where I can find it right now, may not have been aware of it, let's say, half a year ago. So this is one of the things that I'm hearing from your story. This gives me a bit of an extra ease in approaching the whole idea of working with values. And I shouldn't be looking for the essential element of a person's personality or whatever. That's one thing. And on the personal side, I'm just grateful that you shared this very personal experience with me. And it's nice to hear that other professionals have their mind chatter on as well, and that we are not invincible to these thoughts, because I frequently get the question that, okay, you are teaching such stuff and you are coaching people around those topics. We bet that you don't have those thoughts. Well, I try to be authentic all the time as well, whenever I can. And right. I just usually tell them, I have a different kind of chatter.
Yeah.
A different kind of disturbance about myself or my work. And it's really good to know that I'm not alone.
Right. Very welcome. Isn't that interesting? It's one of the kind of like the key things, I think, that sort of connection, that sort of humanity, when we hear about other people's vulnerability or insides. And I think that's probably a really key part of why authenticity is so important to me. Like, to be able, just have said so many times in my life, what I've really benefited from other people's authenticity. Like, even just what you're saying there, like, I connect much more with you. It's like, feels okay to kind of have all this stuff on the inside. Or it's like a really soothing thing to hear that other people just the same as me, for the most part. Other people have struggles, other people have minds, other people have things that rather not have. That's part of the human experience. So authenticity for me drops out of that. And I guess that's the kind of makes me think, the act, acceptance and commit, that's the acceptance bit, which is like a bit I really like, which is that perhaps we don't need to go through life trying to get rid of stuff, or the problem is not my busy worrying mind or my fight with emotions that I don't like. It's that maybe I could accept, or rather breathe into, hold and have and allow those things to be there, because that's who I am. That's part of being human. And I do that so I can do the things I care about. I don't have to spend all my time fighting and not, trying to think positive or trying to be happy all the time, where that's hard. It's a hard battle.
Absolutely. And as I understand it, then in the moments when I'm just accepting my struggles, then I can get an insight into the permissions or the resources that I may have beneath them. Just holding my struggles helps me to free up space in my mind to experience my other parts, my other inner dialogues, my other whatever else that is finds the struggle.
Absolutely. That's a good way to put it. Yeah. There's so much of, like, I feel like society is geared up, Western society at least, has sort of geared us towards this sort of ideal, this sort of happiness, this sense of, I don't know, peak well-being. And it's kind of like has this sort of package in that story is this absence of all the gunk or the yucky stuff, so-called, right? If you say this is good, then inevitably that's saying this stuff is bad. And it just means that all the bad stuff gets such a hard rap, like difficult feelings or parts of ourselves that maybe have got actually not easy, but important messages to convey, or, you know, things that we actually could benefit from really listening to, you know, taking the message from. So rather than trying to have this sort of aspiration of unity or, I don't know, happiness is the word I used, or sort of this one kind of sense of well-being, whatever that is, genuine well-being, I think, can be a real incorporation of all aspects of ourselves.
I had at least three thoughts as you were speaking. Honestly, I forgot them. Three of them, and you and the new one came up. So first, I will just get back to this, because the first one was how non-judgmental it is, or the perspective you are outlining, how non-judgmental it is. That was one of your first sentences, that so many things are put into the box of, bro, this is the ideal, so anything what is not an ideal should be against it, should be bad. So I really like this, the non-judgmental approach. And what I was starting to think as we were talking is, how do you deal with people, clients, who have strong internal stoppers, non-permissions, blockages, choose your word, to not do certain things, like don't be happy?
I think it's one of the key parts of any coaching therapy relationship is understanding those pieces. And probably the more complicated the issue is, more of those things are going to come up. I've sort of got my hands together automatically without thinking about it, like it's a form of knot, because these things often sort of represent knottedness, like a kind of bind or a blockage, stoppage, where things aren't moving forward. And it's nearly as if there's different aspects are fighting against a movement forward. You know, usually by virtue of the person sitting in front of us, it sort of suggests, hey, they want to change, they want to improve their life. And yet they might do lots of behaviors that are completely opposite of that. You know, there's a whole catalog of things that could represent that. Not talking, not opening up, not participating, not doing their homework, not doing any change, not expressing their feelings authentically, all things that get in the way of that block. There's a lot that can come into that. There's one part is, there is a values piece in that. And I think a really nice values piece is not one that sort of starts to set any judgment about the correct way to do things, but perhaps a value that said, kind of like a course, a direction, where both of these parts could come to some agreement, say, about wanting to move towards greater equanimity, for example. I use that word, like, or greater well-being, or without a kind of sort of predefined destination about where that comes to. This is, you know, in a lot of respects, this reminds me a little bit of family therapy, right? Good family therapy. The very first thing you want to do is kind of listen to each of the aspects that are happening, like hear their perspective, like what's going on, and then kind of gradually kind of bring the perspectives together and unify them in a shared direction that they're all happy with. And I think a lot of blockages for people can represent that, whereas a part of them inside, an aspect of themselves that maybe is wary, is scared, is threatened, is doesn't want to change. The kind of part of a good coach and therapist is to really understand that. Because it can be frustrating, intensely frustrating, when a client says, I want to change, but blah, 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 blah. It's like, oh my gosh, how many times have we talked about this? And the person does the exact opposite. The trap is to push against that resistance and push back and trying to say, but you've said this and you want to change. And, you know, of course, you know what happens then? It just gets even more resistant. So the key I usually find is to get some exploration, get that perspective shared. Like, tell me about what's happening there. What are your concerns? What are your fears? And what do you truly want? What are your values? Instead of listening to that different aspect and different part, that bit of sense of self. I know it's a bit of a metaphor, right? That there are different selves in us, but I think it's a useful metaphor. And, you know, not just ACT, it has lots of different therapies. TA, of course, talks about this loads, and there's probably lots of stuff ACT is stolen, maybe?
Influenced by. I love the word of influencing or getting inspired.
Yeah, absolutely. It's hugely
influenced. I think it's a good thing to be inspired by great stuff. So without that, humanity would be reinventing the wheel in every second year. So
exactly.
Let's be inspired by good stuff. So
I'm hugely reassured that that we do that. I would be very worried if it was just continual reinvention. So I feel like there's that kind of really interesting piece is really looking to understand all these different elements and be like a facilitator. So you understand to a degree, how each of these parts functions, how each of these aspects or selves functions, what they want, where they want to get to, and then kind of bring together like a unifying direction that could be a value, could be a shared value between the two.
One of the things that keep coming back as we are talking is the being a coach and or a therapist. I'm just curious on your approach to the boundaries of these professions, like therapy, coaching, counseling. From your perspective, what is the, is there such a thing as a key differentiator between these roles or between the professions? When you would just stop and say, hey, I need to change my hands.
Absolutely. I think I feel like I'm in a bit of a funny role in that I do move between the coaching world and the therapy world, and having training backgrounds in both worlds. And it means I can move backwards and forwards. And I don't think that's always a particularly helpful thing. I think often for the managing that boundary thing, it's much more straightforward if a person is located in one or the other. But, you know, life is not so straightforward, right? A lot of people move backwards and forwards. And that's often a good thing. I think that the knowledge and skills from each area are hugely, enormously helpful across both. So, you know, when I've seen coaches working therapeutically, their ability to understand things like values, to be focused, to be genuine, warm, and action-oriented is hugely beneficial. And also, you know, for a therapist working in a coaching world, having kind of eyes on some of the more developmental stuff, for example, or knowing kind of, you know, this when something is tipping maybe into something a bit more serious or maybe some mental health issues, it can be fantastic. How one separates that out is tricky, but I think a really key part of that is from the outset, having a real clear contract with the person, having a good understanding about where they want to get to and what they want to do. I think, for example, some of the problems for a psychologist or therapist or psychotherapist doing coaching can be often that they don't stick to that because they know they can go into other areas, but they don't stick to the contract. That might not be appropriate. Even if professionally they could, that might not be the appropriate thing to do. The other kind of flip side, of course, is for coaches when they start kind of coming up into what territory that looks like maybe is going to fall out of their skill set, their expertise, or indeed out of the contract that they've agreed with the client in the first place. I guess that's things where things maybe are looking a little bit more serious, perhaps maybe that it's maybe relating to more sort of mental health issues, that they might be the kind of things where some outside expertise is needed. Having said that, though, I also kind of, you know, it's not black and white. I think it's nice to have a little tolerance for some of the gray area and that, and having some good place to discuss with someone else what where that gray area is and where the parameters are, I think is always enormously helpful. Sometimes there's a real danger, I think, when people pull back too quickly. They might have been able to stay with the person just a little longer. That might have been helpful. And of course, you know, staying with the person too long can be productive as well.
I really like your thoughts around contracts. I like to say that my first school around psychology was TA. And for me, the contractual nature of TA was very inspirational. And I think that really fits my way of thinking in general about the role. That could come out very wrongly. I'm not a quid pro quo person, but I just like to have a clear understanding of what's going on. For me, that's really the essence of having a contract with my clients. And so I really like that we are on the same page with contracts. As a therapist, what would be your recommendation for coaches? What are the five things to look out for? Hey, this is a boundary. You shouldn't go over there. But other things that we coaches should be very aware of not to go there, which is definitely behind the gray area. Of course, when someone is, you know, seeing Napoleon in the court, I'm just joking here. So there are certain very obvious behavioral patterns that may call for extra attention. But
yeah,
besides the very, very obvious things,
yeah,
is there anything that you would recommend us to take a look at?
You're pointing to the key problem there, right? Like when it's obvious, everyone knows what to do. It's when it's not obvious that's the thing that becomes trickier. Trickier because things change for a person. They will likely fluctuate week to week. They will maybe even within a session, they might, that degree of kind of seriousness can change. Usually the kind of things I would say to watch out for is getting a sense of the impact that something is having in one's life and whether it's being attuned to things like the impact of anxiety, the impact of low mood, and then the impact of things like that sort of cluster of things around the sense of self, personality stuff, self-esteem that can be really impactful. Connected to all of those things would be the impact of trauma, whether that's a recent trauma the person's been through or a serious or perhaps accumulation of complex traumas. And so, again, that's sort of into that gray territory, because I think a lot of times coaches can be enormously helpful with stuff, and that the contract can identify either that we're going to work on a particular issue here and we know about this stuff over there, and that's okay. That can sit there and remain there. The hallmark features, I would say, is when it's time to get in some additional help or do something else, is when that stuff over there starts to become much more influential in the person's life. So when problems start to impact over more than a period of a few weeks, when it starts to impact on multiple domains. So, you know, someone might be describing some anxiety at work, and suddenly they're describing anxiety at home with their friends, you know, when they wake up first thing in the morning, and it's been around for a long period of time. Those are the kind of times I'd be saying, looking like it's a little bit more serious, and it might not be something that just sort of eases with time. Of course, lots of things do, right? You know, give it a few weeks or a couple of months and things ease and life changes and pressures shift. But if it doesn't, then those are the times where it probably is likely to be beneficial to get someone else in to get a second opinion, perhaps. Very hard to know the difference. That's why I think lots of coaches, of course, ask this question. It's really an important one. Hard to get the right, correct answer.
But for me, what is inspiring in what you are saying is the timely nature of these signals. That you didn't say that, okay, you should pay attention for these kind of words or these kind of contents. But for me, your message was pay attention to the shift in the presence of your clients, whether an issue is getting a broader impact on their lives. So this is not a point like something that we should pay attention for, but something that changes or the nature of the changes that the client is experiencing. Yeah, that's the word I was looking for.
That's a good way to put it, yeah. Like that you're sort of looking for that set of experiences located in time rather than just a slice. You know, I think, gosh, if you were to catch me on a bad day, then you would think, oh my gosh, this guy's got all sorts of things going on. But, you know, speak to me the next day, things have moved on and they're fine. It's that chronicity, the kind of length.
I have a favorite question, because I always like to ask about your favorite thing in your area. Is there a favorite thing that something is very something what is very close to your heart, either in ACT or in therapy, that you would consider as your sweet spot in what you are doing? Is something wrong that you could share with us?
It's probably two pieces. And one is, it's kind of it's the threads that we've been talking about. One is this authenticity piece. This message that ACT, not only ACT, but that I feel is kind of like the antidote is being received in society today to this constant desire and need for self-improvement and betterment and health and well, you know, happiness. Things are changing, right? You know, like there's been such an evolution in terms of approaches and ideas and therapies which promote, sometimes for better or worse, but this idea that as you are is okay. You don't need to fundamentally change. That doesn't mean that there are kind of things that people aren't going to improve on and try and get better, I'm sure. But this sort of sense of real deep level self-acceptance. Warts and all, as a human being, you're welcome, still welcome within the human race. And lots of caveats and rah-rah and exceptions, blah, blah. But that kind of message that comes out is so important. And I feel like one of the things I'm really interested in is promote that. How do we promote and have technologies that allow us to increase the sense of belonging to our groups? You know, whether it's kind of like just you and me talking now, or whether it's I talk with my family, or whether it's when I talk with my colleagues at work, or there's other professional groups I belong to, or, you know, my community, and the bigger and bigger the groups that kind of go outwards. How can we bring people together and allow for the sense of belonging, whilst at the same time, belonging doesn't mean that people have to be homogenous, all exactly the same, but a sense of like, as you are, you're welcome. There's no need to fundamentally improve. And I don't know, world events and everything that goes on, there is a need for us as a species to find those ways, those methods, those technologies to do this so we can, as a species, have a sort of a global sense of togetherness and moving forward. I don't know what that's going to, maybe it's an alien invasion. That's the thing that we need to kind of be confronted with to finally bring us together. But I hope it's not something quite so threatening, but methods that allow us to belong legitimately and genuinely, I think are really important. That matters to me.
Thank you. So authenticity and belonging. Well, thank you very much. These are wonderful closing words, if you allow me to say that. Thank you very much for the conversation, for your time, and for everything you have shared. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much for having me on. I've really enjoyed it too. And I've really enjoyed your thought-provoking questions. And yeah, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to On Coaching Podcast, where I have curious conversations with world-renowned coaches and researchers. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to rate us and subscribe. I also invite you to visit zoltanchigesh.com, where you can access more resources regarding the coaching industry. Be well.